Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Item one, the week that was. Item two, the price of corn. Item three, the economic history of the bikini. Yes, a little bit of everything on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 11th of July. Good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It being a Friday, what say we start by going backward a bit. Take in, I don't know, 4 minutes to digest the week gone by. For that, we've got Felix Salmon from Fusion and Jolene Kent from Fox Business. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so Felix, what about that big news, the LeBron James news? What do you think?
As a Miami
person. I'm kidding. Come on.
LeBron. I know who you're talking about.
American
now.
Great for the Cleveland economy.
Great for the Cleveland economy, and that's as far as we're going with that story. In all seriousness, Felix, come on. Portugal, Europe, again, debt. Are you kidding?
The Banco Espirito Santo. They're a huge Portuguese bank run by a rather opaque family, which seems to have got itself into trouble, and we don't know how far this trouble is going to spread. And the European stock markets are trembling because they're worried that this could be the beginning of another crisis.
So, Joe, is this real, or is it everybody just getting a little utsy on this because we're so scarred from 3 years ago?
Well, it certainly sounds like it's impacting the markets in Europe, but looking at it from a U.S. perspective in the global market, it doesn't seem to really impact the market here. You remember we opened yesterday with these big lows, and then we ended up, as the day went on, Europe closed, and we seemed to sort of forget about it. Investors moved on, and there is a lot of data that we're digesting. We're looking at France and Chinese trade data. Yeah. Japan had a record drop in machine orders or something. So overall, though, the U.S. market doesn't seem to mind.
Felix, real peril or no from Europe for us?
A big bank failure is always a problem, and we don't know whether there's going to be a big bank failure, but if it cascades across Europe, there's no way that the rest of the world will be out of harm's reach. It's a low probability event, but it's a non-zero probability.
Where have we heard those words before? All right. Joe, the Federal Reserve minutes came out from their June meeting in which there was nothing earth-shattering other than the taper will continue. They'll be done by October. And interest rates still aren't going up anytime soon. Status quo, right?
Yeah, it really is. We knew it was going to end in October, the taper. But what's interesting is you have dueling Fed speakers right now. Blosser came out. He's from Philly. He's saying, we should consider hiking rates in response to the improving outlook. And then you've got the Minneapolis Fed president saying, maybe we should stay at zero even past 2015. So looks, though, that the Fed's going to maintain that accommodating position.
And can I just say for the record, Narayana Kocherlakota, because he does have the best name of any Fed president.
He does.
I know. But Felix, the question is, of which of them should we listen to, if any, or should we just wait until Janet Yellen comes out and does a press conference?
I think we should listen to Kocherlakota, honestly. He's by far the most interesting guy. He's the one who changes his mind when the facts change. He's dovish right now. He's saying we should keep rates low because there's no really inflationary pressure. We need to get inflation up, and until we get inflation up, we should keep the rates at essentially zero. That makes sense to me.
It might make sense, but Joe, let me ask you this. You remember how back in the Greenspan years it was always like Alan Greenspan said this and Alan Greenspan said that, and there were no dueling speeches back then, right? It was Greenspan was the voice. How much does it matter now that we have all these other members of the Board of Governors going out and making speeches?
Well, it gives the market more to digest, I suppose. But if you look at what everyone's actually focused on, any action, it really seems to be focused on Janet Yellen, the Fed chair. Right. When she is focusing on a lot on long-term people being out of work, long-term. Right. And that's something, that slack that she's going to be watching very closely. We're looking at the labor force participation rate as well. So it seems to me that it's a focus on Fed Chair Yellen.
Focus on Yellen, yeah. All right, Felix, very quickly, our friend John Carney has a post up at the Wall Street Journal today talking about how nice it is to see healthy bank profits. J.P. Morgan reports on Monday. Wells Fargo came out today. Banks are healthy. That's a good thing, right?
I suppose so. I'm a little bit shocked.
Could you be more bored?
No, I'm saying, listen, Wells Fargo made $5.7 billion in one quarter.
Yep.
That's an insane amount of money to be making in one quarter. That's over $60 million a day, counting weekends.
Wow.
So I'm a little bit worried. The financial sector shouldn't be that profitable. They shouldn't be extracting those rents from the rest of the economy.
We leave it there. Felix Salmon from Fusion and Jolene Kent from Fox Business. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, humdrum, ho-hum. Certainly not a humdinger. Yes, I got a little slap happy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So here is a question. What do you do if you're in an industry that is inexorably getting smaller? To read the mergers and acquisitions news today, the answer seems to be you got to get bigger. The second biggest cigarette maker in this country, Reynolds American, is trying to buy the third biggest cigarette maker in this country, Lorillard. At stake in the deal are brands like Newport and Camel, and if you read the fine print, perhaps the very future of the tobacco industry. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the story.
About 18% of adults in the U.S. smoke, and that's been going down steadily. It was 45% in the 50s.
The tobacco epidemic is slowly going away.
Stanton Glantz is professor of medicine at UC San Francisco.
People are smoking less. They're smoking fewer cigarettes than they used to.
And yet,
the U.S. tobacco category is in decent shape right now.
Lisa Lewandowski is a vice president in equity research at Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
The volumes in the category are declining, about 3 to 4% annually, but the companies are able to take pricing to largely offset the volume shortfall.
Meaning tobacco companies have been raising prices faster than people have stopped smoking. They've also been consolidating, like with the proposed acquisition of Lorillard by Reynolds.
This creates an industry duopoly in which it's more likely that pricing is less competitive.
Phil Gorham is senior equity analyst at Morningstar. He says this will make it easier to raise prices even more later to offset future declines in smoking. But there's more than puffing up prices to this acquisition. Lorillard makes menthol-flavored Newports. And while sales of most other cigarettes are declining in the U.S., sales of menthols are not.
Newport is playing in a niche in the market that's flat to declining at a much slower pace than the rest.
Lorillard also owns Blue e-cigarettes,
which is an established intellectual property in the e-cigs category.
Gorham says roughly 20% of the decline in traditional cigarette smoking is attributable to e-cigarettes, though they aren't used widely. So if the tobacco business in the U.S. is slowly burning out, Reynolds is buying a few extra years of breathing room. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The White House made one of those mostly symbolic but substantive on the margins public announcements today. It's a voluntary program called Supplier Pay, which is a catchier name than what the thing actually is and belies its actual importance, a way to improve small business cash flow. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
26 companies are participating in Supplier Pay. Big guys like Apple and Coca-Cola. They're promising to pay the small businesses they hire for parts or services quickly, ideally within 15 days. That sounds like heaven to small business owner Rexanne Metzger. Now,
there's a very few corporations that will pay in 30 days. It's more like 45 days.
Metzger is president of Davis Interiors in Norfolk, Virginia. They make custom interiors for Navy ships, working as a supplier for the big defense contractors. She's had to take out a line of credit to cover her bills. She says even if those companies paid her just a few days faster, that would help.
It does help because then we don't have to pay that interest on our line of credit. Every day that we don't get paid costs us money.
Small businesses across the country are feeling the pinch of late payments. Janet Sanders sees it every day. She's CEO of Income Direct, which helps small businesses process credit card payments. Sanders says now her average client needs the day's charges fast.
At the end of the day, he wants those electronic transactions converted to cash as quickly as possible and put back into his bank account.
Charles Mulford teaches accounting at Georgia Tech. He says this is a trend. Big companies have been taking longer to pay their small suppliers since the recession.
It's free money, basically.
Mulford says big corporations are taking 35 to 40 days to pay, a few days more than before the economic downturn. He understands why they do it.
The larger companies can essentially borrow from smaller companies and not pay interest, in effect, on that money.
Will the president's supplier pay initiative help? Mulford says that's not clear, but at least it'll call attention to the problem. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There was a rare bit of good news this week in the long-running story out of Nigeria, the hundreds of girls who've been kidnapped by the Islamist group Boko Haram. 63 of those girls are said to have escaped and made it to safety. Of course, that does leave dozens and dozens at least still in captivity. The Nigerian government has been widely criticized and ridiculed for its inability to rescue the girls or to do almost anything to help them, in fact. And it's been shamed by that global campaign under the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. Even Michelle Obama got in on that one. So what is a country with a bad rap supposed to do? The answer, of course, is get some good PR. Kate Davidson reports.
Here's what Nigeria's image problem sounds like.
The authorities had no number for how many girls were taken.
The country's first lady expressed doubts that there was any kidnapping.
A government with no idea where they are.
We want our girls back now. Now.
That is a PR nightmare, which is why someone in Nigeria called in the image pros.
I think there is a narrative that the government was not doing enough.
Mark Irian is president of the public relations firm Levick, which has signed a $1.2 million contract to galvanize support for the Nigerian government and its fight against terrorism. Levick's motto is communicating trust. Irian says much of the storyline about Nigeria's tepid response to the crisis
is not true. There are things that are underway and are public, and there are things that, of course, cannot be publicly discussed. But yes, there is a false narrative that we intend to correct.
It's no coincidence the Washington Post recently ran an op-ed from Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. "My silence has been necessary," he wrote, "to avoid compromising the details of our investigation." J. Peter Pham directs the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. He says the fact is Nigeria has failed to deal with Boko Haram over the years.
Cannot spin that reality any more than you can spin the fact that there are more than 200 schoolgirls still missing and Boko Haram continues to attack with impunity throughout northeastern Nigeria.
Now, trying to improve the image of foreign governments is nothing new. It's big business for PR firms like Ketchum, which made more than $10 million from its foreign clients last year, including Russia. Ketchum continued to represent Russia after it annexed Crimea. Still, part of this business is knowing who to represent and when to stop.
Everyone has their own litmus test.
Toby Moffat is a former congressman who ran the Moffat Group, one of the firms that lobbied and did communications for Egypt under Hosni Mubarak and the military council that replaced him. Until, that is, Egyptian police raided U.S.-backed NGOs and barred some Americans from leaving the country.
I did receive a call from a friend who happened to be President Obama's Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, and Ray was not happy, to put it mildly.
LaHood's son was one of the Americans who was temporarily trapped in Egypt. Moffat says he would have dropped the Egypt account anyway, but
you know, there was that kind of gentle persuasion, shall we say.
When it comes to foreign governments, it turns out gentle persuasion can run both ways. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
God forbid you would see any skin.
The final installment of our series, Summer, brought to you by... But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 28 points today. A 10% closed at 16,943. The NASDAQ climbed back 19 points, 0.4%, 4417. The S&P 500 added 2 points, a 10%, 1968. For the week, though, the Dow off 0.7%, the NASDAQ down 1.6%, the S&P 500 slid 0.9%. Okay, so in honor of LeBron James coming home, let us now praise Cleveland Fortune 500 company, shall we? Goodyear Tire and Rubber, based in James's hometown of Akron, gained 0.1% today. Did you know, by the way, that the Cleveland region is called Polymer Valley sometimes because of companies like Goodyear? Sherwin-Williams, more polymers, put on 0.2%. Parker Hennepin, which makes motion-controlled equipment like hydraulics, moved up 0.2%. Remember, you heard it here first, Polymer Valley. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The U.S. Energy Information Administration holds its annual energy conference in Washington. If you're in France, you probably have the day off. It's Bastille Day. His long list of credits include roles in Alien, Pretty in Pink, and Big Love. Harry Dean Stanton turns 88. And some people observe Cell Phone Courtesy Month. Some people. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You might not have been able to recognize the face of Eileen Ford, who died this week at the age of 92, but you surely know some of the faces she made famous. Christy Brinkley, Naomi Campbell, and Elle Macpherson, to name just a couple of them. She also made them very, very rich. Ford and her husband created Ford Models, which became the most influential modeling agency in the world. She not only defined beauty in America for decades, tall, thin, and usually blonde, she virtually created the modern modeling industry, as Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
When the Fords started their agency in the 1940s, modeling wasn't really a business, and models were not what they are today.
First of all, models were considered one step above showgirls, and showgirls were one step above prostitutes.
Michael Gross is author of Model, The Ugly Business of Beautiful Women. He says Jerry and Eileen Ford made modeling a true profession and revolutionized how models were paid by setting up a fee structure.
A model would take a picture. Her pay depended upon how that picture was used. So if it was used in an ad, she would get one check. If it was used on a tag hanging off a dress, she would get another. The Fords were amazing at doing that and at raising the hourly rate and the daily rate of models.
Gross says by the 70s, models were pulling in as much as $100,000 per fashion show. Today, supermodels like Naomi Campbell make millions. Some of Ford's discoveries left modeling for other professions.
A pomegranate arrangement like this, it's a good thing.
Yes, that's Martha Stewart, who was a Ford model in the 1960s. Despite the fact that Eileen Ford built an empire, she regarded herself as a woman of limited talents, which she wryly noted in a documentary.
Let me point out to you that I have absolutely no talent. I could only do one thing. I could find models.
Ford Models is no longer owned by the family, but it's still big in the business of multi-million dollar faces. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
If you had corn at your 4th of July barbecue last week, you were getting a bargain. Corn is as cheap now as it's been in years. 4 years, to be just a bit more precise. As it happens, we know a corn farmer, Keith Alverson, out near Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Met him last year when we were out there with Jim Fallows and our series American Futures. So we got him back on the phone. Keith, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back on. It's a pleasure to talk to you as well.
Let me just read to you the headline from the Corn and Soybean Digest that I grabbed on the way into the studio here. It says, corn prices losing pop after June 30th crop reports. There's lots of corn out there, lots of corn.
There is. Boy, you know, I talked to some folks this morning, and they're talking about big potential this time of year, and the weather looks pretty favorable going forward here.
Are you confident that you will be able to sell all your corn, even in a declining price market?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's just a matter of what price point you want to market it at. And so finding a place to put the corn is not an issue. But one of the things we've run into here in South Dakota is actually being able to physically get rid of the product. I shouldn't say get rid of it, but I mean transport it.
I know what you mean. Well, so literally, what do you do with it?
You know, around here, it's going to be gearing up for storage. We've had several of the local elevators adding storage, adding bunker storage, just in preparation for a big harvest coming up, you know, knowing that they're not going to get rid of the 2013 crop. And so they're going to have 2 years of crop on storage or, you know, portions of each.
Wow, yeah. To get some perspective here, what is a bushel of your corn going for now versus, say, a year ago?
Oh, boy. You know, we've got I looked at the cash price here this morning, and, you know, I think right now I could haul in some cash corn for around $3.50 a bushel.
Okay.
And I would venture to say that that is probably a $1, $1.50
wow.
lower than what we saw last summer.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, pretty substantial. And we've seen a big, you know, as you mentioned with the headlines, just a dramatic drop here over the course of the last few months.
You are a family farmer, I think sixth generation from when we were out there in Sioux Falls a year or so ago. Are you going to lose money? I mean, you're a family farmer guy. Are you going to lose money now on this year's crop?
You know, we were able to go into the season and, you know, we made some grain sales ahead of time, you know, at nice profitable levels. And we try and manage our costs wisely. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm not to the point where I'm in the red, but, you know, if we see continued pressure on the markets, it's not out of the realm of possibilities to dip into that area.
You're not in harvest yet, are you? Your corn is still on the dirt there.
Yeah, you know, our corn here in South Dakota is probably about chest high in our area. You know, but different places of the Corn Belt are, you know, as you move further south, they plant it earlier, which they typically do. It just warms up earlier. And so they're going to be going into a pretty critical time called tasseling, and that's when the ear actually pollinates.
Yep.
So one of the things that I think the market's looking at is the fact that there's going to be adequate moisture and cool conditions during tasseling, because that's essential to big yields, is having nice weather during that.
It's all like chemistry, man, right? I mean, it's kind of magic the way this works.
Yeah. You know, I mean, biology. You know,
biology.
There you go.
It's science, whatever.
Yeah. the wonders of Mother Nature. Yeah.
Keith Alverson is a corn farmer out in Chester, South Dakota, not far from Sioux Falls. Keith, thanks very much for your time. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
All right, we are going to wrap up our series now on the people and stories behind some of the things that we use every summer. We've done pool noodles, the super soaker, rollerblades, even those oval European-looking travel stickers that you see on cars. And we will end today with one of the more obvious choices for a series titled Summer, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
The Bikini made its debut 68 years ago this week. So to tell the surprisingly economic story of how it became the semi-official bathing suit of summer, here is Rico Galliano, one of the hosts of Dinner Party Download.
Had Sports Illustrated existed in the year 1900, its swimsuit issue would not have been especially titillating. Aya Kanaya is fashion director at Cosmopolitan magazine, and she says ladies' bathing suits of the day were conservative.
When we're talking about the early 20th century, we're seeing these very covered up, almost looking like a dress, to be quite frank, flannel and wool, because God forbid you would see any skin.
Later, during World War II, the economy took precedent over modesty. The U.S. government needed fabric for the war effort, so relatively skimpy swimwear came into vogue, but it still didn't usually expose anything so scandalous as a belly button.
Don't know what the wild waves are saying, but the gals are talking about the latest thing in swimming attire, a suit with a built-in girdle.
But post-war, a couple of Frenchmen sensed the world was ready to loosen up. The first of them, named Jacques Haim, designed a two-piece bathing suit so tiny he called it l'atome, the atom. But Haim was one-upped by his countryman, Louis Rayard. On July 5th, 1946, at a swimming pool in Paris, he had a model show off an even tinier suit, the Bikini, named after a Pacific Island atoll where 4 days earlier an atomic bomb had been tested.
The mushroom cloud gains altitude with amazing speed.
Rayard wanted to provoke a similar explosive shock, and it worked. Depending which news account you believe, either Rayard himself or his model received 50,000 fan letters, mostly from grateful guys, while in some countries shocked lawmakers and stated bikini bans. Rayard happily embraced the controversy. In ads, he said his bikinis were small enough to be, quote, pulled through a wedding ring. Eventually, of course, the anti-bikini lobby collapsed as the suit became popular on European beaches and eventually even in the conservative U.S. of A. Cosmopolitan's Aya Kanai.
Americans get acclimated to new ideas through celebrities, so it was film stars who helped the bikini to gain popularity and to gain acceptance.
Thanks to bikini-clad starlets like Brigitte Bardot, by 1960, Rayar's invention was seen more frequently on American shores. The same year, singer Brian Hyland scored a number one hit.
2, 3, 4, tell the people what she wore.
About a girl too embarrassed to be seen in it.
It was an itsy-bitsy, teeny-weeny, yellow polka dot bikini that she wore for the first time today. An itsy-bitsy, teeny-weeny.
Rico Galliano from the Dinner Party Download there. The DPD has interesting little tidbits of history like that in every single show, which, even better, they then pair with a special drink. We've got the recipe for the nuclear bikini at our website. It's marketplace.org. Everybody sing.
And I wonder what she's gonna do. Now she's afraid to come out of the water. And the poor little girl's turning blue.
2, 3, 4, tell the people.
You guys still singing? All right, good. This final note today, in which those various and sundry airport taxes may finally, at long last, have jumped the shark. From Caracas, Venezuela, this item today. Outbound passengers at the international airport there will now have to pay 127 bolivars, about 20 bucks at the official rate of exchange, to breathe, basically. The government apparently needs to cover the cost of a newly installed system that uses ozone to purify the air conditioning system in the terminal there. No word, by the by, on what happens if you don't pay. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Friday. Today, the Dow up 28 points, about a 0.1%. The NASDAQ up 19 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 added 2 points, a 0.1% down for the week, though. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. You guys know my name. We're back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.